Welcome back to another episode of the Brawn Body Health and Fitness Podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Katie Dabrowski. Katie and I are going to be discussing training, healthcare, neuroscience, and we also talk about cheese and true crime and so many other amazing things. This was a really good episode. I had a lot of respect and appreciation for Katie and her team at Old Bull going into this. And after I listened to this podcast myself to edit it, my respect probably doubled, tripled. I really like Katie. I really like what her team at Old Bull is doing. And I really think you're going to love this episode. I highly recommend you check out everything Katie is doing and everything her team at Old Bull is doing. And while you're checking them out, you should also check out our season five sponsor, ISOFIT. They're doing amazing things as well. Enjoy. Katie, welcome to the podcast. I'm super excited to work with you today. Thank you so much for your time and for being here.
Yeah, I'm very excited too. Thanks for having me.
For people who might not be familiar with you, or maybe they haven't heard about all the incredible things you do down there in Miami with Old Bull, would you mind filling them in a little bit about who you are and all that you do?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm a physical therapist and strength coach, and I really believe in kind of blending the two worlds and, quite frankly, not being able to tell which one I'm doing when I'm working with a client. And that's what we do at Old Bull. Old Bull is an amazing facility in Miami. We actually have two locations. And we are a team of rehab providers who, again, kind of wear a couple hats. We're rehab providers and we're strength coaches and we're trainers. And we like to be able to meet a client wherever they're at, whether that's recovering from an injury, working on something preoperatively to prepare them for a surgery, recovering postoperatively, or strength and conditioning and performance. We just want to be able to provide the highest level of care wherever they fall on that spectrum. So that's what we do. And we're really passionate about just kind of like creating a different healthcare experience, one that people haven't really had before. That's what we get to do every day at Old Bull. We have an amazing team of therapists, athletic trainers, strength coaches, performance coaches, and I can't speak highly enough of them. It's the environment, it's a really special place, and it's because of our team.
Yeah, definitely. And I've had the privilege of getting to know several members of your team in the past, and all of them have been absolutely incredible. I love your point on blurring the lines between strength and conditioning and PT. I think that is absolutely essential. I'm kind of surprised, though. I've been told a little bit about you, and I've heard that you have this like addiction to cheese. I'm shocked that you didn't like share like your favorite kind of cheese. Like, what exactly makes a good cheese in the first place, Katie?
I'm so glad you asked because really, usually I talk about strength and conditioning and physical therapy, but I'm glad that somebody finally recognized my real passion in life, which is cheese. Everybody at work makes so much fun of me. Actually, it literally just happened today. I had a few meetings. I got into the gym to get my lift, and I immediately went to the back room and had my pre-workout cheese. And everybody, all of the team members at Old Bull just like looked at me and were like, "Well, there she goes again." Yeah, I don't really have a better explanation other than I do have a weird obsession with cheese, and it is a main food group, and I probably get most of my protein intake from cheese.
That
So I'm really glad that you asked. Thank you.
is absolutely amazing. What is the go-to pre-workout cheese? I've never tried that
I've never met a cheese I don't like, so there's unlimitless potential, right now I'm on the Baybel kick, the little guys that come in the wax. They're just easy. Stick it in your pocket, you have it always. Yeah, so just a day in the life,
I love that, the pocket cheese. I'll have to pull that out the next time I'm at the gym. I'm sure
A
I'll get some
conversation
interesting looks.
starter or
Yeah.
ender, to be honest. Yeah.
How people respond to that is going to tell you a lot about them, I feel.
Exactly. Yes. I use it as a metric.
I love that. I love that. Outside of cheese, I know you do a lot of training stuff. Where exactly did you get started in the training world that way?
I've always been involved in sports. I grew up, I started with gymnastics at a super young age, which I feel like creates a pretty good foundation for strength and just being able to control your body. And I don't really come from a family that does a lot of sports or athletic stuff. So I kind of stumbled into realizing that I was like, oh, I ran the mile as in elementary school. And I was like, oh, I can do this. I'm pretty decent at running. So running was kind of the first thing that I was exposed to and really loved. And so I did cross country, I played lacrosse, and then when I got to high school, I found rowing and I fell in love with rowing, and then ultimately was recruited to row in college, rowed in college, at the Division II level. And you know, it was just a huge part of my athletic development. I think it's why I'm kind of like a hybrid athlete now, where I really love to, you know, across the board, I want to be strong, I want to be fast, I want to have endurance, and I want to be springy. So that's what I've been working on, and I think a lot of it comes from rowing. That's, you know, you have an engine, it's a horrific sport, so nothing ever feels as terrible as rowing does. So everything after that has honestly felt manageable, because it's just such an intense sport. And you know, I really fell in love with strength training during high school and college rowing. So that's where it all started.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, first off, I love your point on the gymnastics, and that was something we talked about with Hannah. It is such an impressive sport, or really art form, I guess I should say, to watch. I mean, the amount of just incredible calisthenic feats that y'all can pull off. I am still struggling with my handstands. It's been 2, 3 months. It's a work in progress, but we're getting there. So I completely echo your point on the importance of gymnastics and just some really well done, like human force GPP, for lack of a better way to put it. You had me when you said that you loved running, though, because that's something I've never felt myself.
I get that reaction a lot.
I
I
got
don't
to tip
know.
my hat to you for that.
I think I don't know what it is. I think when I just realized that I was pretty good at it from a young age, like I feel like a lot of kids are exposed to running because it's a punishment, and you know, punishment in sport or something that everybody dreads. And I just kind of stumbled into realizing, oh, I'm actually pretty good at this. And I really fell in love with it. It's been weirdly, I mean, as much as I love strength training, running is my first love, and it's actually what I think I enjoy the most in training. It's why I've always included it in some form. So that's why this kind of hybrid athlete thing that everybody's doing now, I mean, it's really quite perfect for what my interests are. So yeah, I've always loved it. It's weird. And it's been something that, I mean, I've been doing ever since I found out that I could run the mile and be pretty good at it. I've been involved in it for a long time.
You brought up such an interesting point there, Katie, about how running was often used in punishment for a lot of sports. And to a certain extent, exercise was used as punishment for a lot of sports. I still remember, high school football, if we messed up, it was like push-ups or burpees or something like that, like something exercise-based. And I can't help but wonder, I know the state of, the health trends in the country have been quite alarming over the past several years. I can't help but wonder if that plays into at least in part why people are struggling to like fall in love with the process of training and exercise and just improving their overall like health status, for lack of a better way to put it.
Yeah, I'm sure that absolutely plays a big part in the big picture of everything. I think it's so multifactorial, and I think you could even go as far as to think of like an evolutionary lens of why we wouldn't necessarily select to make our resources depleted in exercise. Like, I think there's a lot to be said about even going quite as deep as that, and then also being in a world where we have a lot of stuff at our fingertips, and we don't necessarily have to put in as much effort for things anymore. So it's challenging to conjure up the desire to do something that just sucks sometimes. I also think just people are confused, and the barrier to entry is so high for exercise that, you know, when you have social media at your fingertips telling you constantly what is good or bad, what is right or wrong, and what is a good form of exercise versus what they claim is dangerous, like, what's the difference between HIIT and aerobic, like improving your aerobic capacity? What's zone two? Why is CrossFit so dangerous and bad for you? Which is, you know, again, not something I agree with, but things that people are getting conflicting information all the time. So how the heck do you know where to start if you're getting all that information?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And to your point too, on the lack of like a common language almost. It's like what you call a split squat, I might call a lunge. It's like same exercise, but we're calling it two different things. So that overall
Absolutely.
lacking of like a common language, a common ground to stand on. And I think most of the time we tend to argue over stupid little just stuff that doesn't matter. Like, we're arguing over like the best RDL variation when my client can't even do an RDL. It's like,
Correct.
can we at least just start from the ground up, like focus on the big picture foundational things instead of getting so caught up in the little like minute details? And maybe I'm guilty of doing that myself. But to a certain extent, we really, I think, need to do better at taking a step back and focusing on the foundational, fundamental things instead of the little things that probably don't matter nearly as much as we think they do.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I really think that with the barrier to entry to exercise being as high as it already is, yeah, arguing about these like nuanced things that probably don't matter to the general population probably really only matter if you're at an extremely elite level. And most of us aren't training people who are, or ourselves, we're general population. So a lot of this stuff I think becomes really confusing and nuanced and almost like posturing to show that I know more, so I have to disagree with everything. And I always tell my clients or anybody that I talk to about this, I'm very agnostic when it comes to the mode of exercise. I just want people to find something that they're going to do and that they like. I don't really care what it is. If you become obsessed with you know, a group training class that you love and you get to have community, and are you getting the perfect stimulus every time? No, but are you exercising? Are you around people that you're excited to be around? Oh my gosh, that's fantastic. So when it comes to the mode, again, I just want people to do something. And then if they have more specific goals, that starts to matter more. But a lot of the arguing and the posturing of who knows more, it's exhausting.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And adding to that is the effect that you brought up earlier about, you know, the social media element, the concept of everything anymore is just instantly delivered, and exercise is really a delayed gratification piece. And you even mentioned it with the rowing as well. Like sometimes training just sucks. Like I have a assault bike workout that I'm becoming infamous for amongst my patients. We call it assault bike to hell, and it starts with 50 calories as fast as possible, and it decreases by 5 calories. And your goal is to get it all the way down to zero as quick as you can. And it sucks.
My
Like
God.
it my lungs are on fire every time. But there's this certain element of we have to dive into like hard training in order to get results after a certain time. But it's very difficult for people, at least initially, to kind of like buy into that. And at least from my side, I think it's almost like a confidence thing almost. Like, hey, I've never, you know, I'm new to this, not really sure what I'm doing. And now I'm getting thrown into the fire and I suck at it. I'm puking afterwards. Like it's almost like we need to like progress people up to that point, but meet them where they're at in the first place. And I think that's something I've noticed you do all the time at Old Bull from like a rehab standpoint, right? Like you literally start people from level one post-op sometimes all the way up to level 100, getting them back to all these crazy sport related things. I almost think that to your point about the lines being gray, we need to make that the standard for everyone who just wants to start in the fitness and exercise space.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's so much value to finding, like, just meeting somebody where they're at and finding their entry point and then progressively building them up and giving them the confidence. You know, a lot of things that I think we take for granted as people who we like to exercise and we like this feeling of doom with that horrific workout that you just mentioned. And we just, I think sometimes we have to remember and take a step back and be really grateful. Like, we've selected this profession. We sign up for events and competitions and races, and we put ourselves through this stuff because we really enjoy it. And that's not the case with everybody. And we can't necessarily make everybody feel that passionate about it. But I think if we show how excited we are, and if we show why this is so important in our lives, that starts to bleed into how our clients and patients feel too. And being like genuinely excited for what our body can do year over year, I think is a really great starting point. You know, something that I've enjoyed actually now I'm into my 30s, like I think I have almost even a little bit more skin in the game when I'm talking with my clients because I'm not just the fresh out of college athlete who basically has it as easy as you're ever going to get it to be successful, be strong, make the strides and gains that you're going to make in the gym. Now, the conversations that I can have with my clients are like, I'm so excited to see what every new decade brings because I can't wait to see how continually strong and fast and agile I can be. And if you can relay that to your client, they start to get excited about aging in a very different way and about what progress can look like in a very different way. So meeting somebody kind of at the ground floor and then watching them fall in love with the process to where I might have thought that I was only going to see this person for their rehab needs. And then now they've seen what is possible And we've taken it, as you said, to level 100, and we're doing just strength and conditioning and performance. And I think that's so exciting and empowering for people to see, and it gives people a different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, the human body really is limitless. I mean, there's like I refuse to accept like the fact that we've hit the like peak of human potential yet when it comes to the physical performance world. Like we are still learning so much, and we are continuing to evolve our approaches and see records being shattered, you know, year after year after year. It's really quite impressive. And there's an area in particular that I've noticed we've really evolved our understanding of in relation to like the nervous system and how the nervous system impacts training and exercise and really like everything we do. And it's funny because I remember when I was in PT school, this was the area that I always like glossed over. I was like, really, we have to go into like the nervous system? Like, this is stupid. Why do I have to learn this? And here I am now, and I'm like, man, I really should have paid a little more attention back then. There was so much good stuff, and I wish I hit the books a little harder. But for people who aren't familiar with like neuroscience and how neuroscience relates to like exercise and fitness, would you mind kind of like breaking it down a little bit for them? Because I believe that's like one of your like main staples in what you do.
Yes, my background's in neuroscience. It's actually what I was the world that I was in before PT school, kind of in like the research and publication world. And I actually teach neuroscience where I went to undergrad now. So I get to kind of experience, in my opinion, best of both worlds clinically and then teaching neuroscience. And yeah, I mean, I think what's really important to consider is that it's the neuromuscular system that we're talking about when we exercise, and everything starts with the brain signaling for a muscle to contract, or sensory perception from your own tissues or the environment coming into your body and then going to your brain to process what to do next. You can't have one without the other. You know, it's I remember in PT school as well, even like in cardiopulmonary PT, I was like, oh my God, this is so intense. But everybody has a heart. Like, we need to know this stuff. This is inextricably linked to exercise. And the same thing with the nervous system. You know, the brain, and this becomes incredibly important for especially as a rehab provider and trainers, because trainers see people in pain too. You know, the when it comes to experiencing pain, you know, the brain's job is to predict based on inputs from the environment, past experiences, sensations coming in from your own tissues, to create an output that is, you know, matching with what is most likely to occur. So this becomes really important for people who've experienced pain for a long time. The brain wants to create shortcuts because, like, it has a lot of important things to do. So anything that it can do to decrease its resources is hugely helpful. So we're going to use these heuristics or these shortcuts to look at the environment, look at our past experiences, look at how we feel, and create a hypothesis for what's going to happen. It's a prediction. So if somebody's had pain all of the time when they deadlift, and then they're also being told by everybody that deadlifting makes your spine explode, and then they've also seen on Instagram a video of spinal flexion causing the jelly donut of a disc to squeeze out, if they're getting all of this input, the brain is absolutely going to predict and create a scenario. Okay, well, next time you deadlift, you're probably going to experience pain. That sets you up for expectations that can increase our pain experience. So understanding the brain is so important for understanding exercise. Of course, the physiology, like how muscle contraction happens, it starts with the brain. And then also more applied, just understanding how human beings deal with pain and predict the pain experience. That's exactly what we try to help people with all day.
Yeah, it sounds very much like your perceptions and beliefs in relation to what your body can do based on what you've been told and what you've learned really dictate like what we see from a movement and like function standpoint, for lack of a better way to put it. And I think to your point earlier about the progression of training over time, I think this is where training can become a little bit more like mentally empowering and impactful for people, is we kind of break the glass on that, for lack of a better way to put it. We say, well, these are the things that you think you can do. You can actually do more. We just need to almost like make you feel or believe that you can do it, instead of just a matter of like, it's more of like a mental belief that we can actually do it.
Yeah, and absolutely. And that's why I think it's important to consider the like progressive overload is not just a physical thing that you're doing by adding more load week over week or whatever intensity metric that you're changing, you're also getting neurological progressive overload. You're getting psychological progressive overload. You're getting things to help the individual understand that they can do more and not just physically. And I think that's what is so important. And that's why the lines should be blurred with training and rehab, because this is my biggest complaint is if progressive overload is the gold standard of training, why is it not of rehab? It's, if anything, like this is an even bigger opportunity to make somebody more resilient. So I don't understand why we're not doing these techniques and actually employing strength and conditioning principles for our rehab population, because we absolutely need the physical change, yes, but also the mental, psychological, like, and neurological changes to occur with doing more week over week.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, we see it in the post-op ACL population all the time, right? Like, you know, their quad doesn't magically disappear in a day or 2 days, but the body neurologically sends so much inhibition signals that it literally shuts the thing down. And we have to re-educate the process of bringing that back and overload it over time. I love that you brought up the overload topic here as well, because I almost feel like we as providers need to be training ourselves through an overload system to really understand the effects that it has. And what I mean by that is, like, I've programmed like 3 or 4 heavy days in a row for myself this week. And at this point, I am freaking exhausted. Like, I'm ready to like curl up on the couch, take a nap, and just call it a day. And I don't necessarily want the patients and clients I work with to feel like that all the time. Like, I want them to feel energetic and empowered. So it's kind of like understanding the effect of the dose that we give in relation to exercise and how it impacts us from like a psychological and neurological standpoint, right? Like, I want people to feel empowered, so I need to dose overload, but I can't overdose it because there's a certain point where, you know, they're going to just feel like exhausted and in, like, we're calling it like the training low, for lack of a better way to put it. Or maybe there's times where I want that stimulus and I say, look, you know, we're just gonna have to push forward and suck it up for a week or two, and I'm gonna put someone into that state, but I know they're going to end up there, and I'm going to adjust my approach accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where I would argue one of the most important conversations in my initial evaluation and throughout my treatment process with somebody is understanding what their current training program is, finding whatever the gaps are, or instances where there is clearly too much training stress or too little training stress, and having a conversation about that and working together to create something that's more optimal for what their goals are. You know, something I say all of the time is, you know, in the absence of tissue trauma or like an accident, most pain is because we've done too much too soon or consistently done too little and then asked our bodies to do a lot. So it really comes down to the program. What are you currently doing? What is your goal? Are you anywhere close to mimicking that in your training? Are you overdoing it? Are you underdoing it? And I think that's hugely important. And to your point, if we don't know what that feels like for ourselves, I don't really think we can accurately help somebody go through that process. I've been humbled when I've done things that I clearly would tell a client not to do, and I create the perfect storm of events for me to have pain. Like, I'm doing everything. I go off program. I do 2 lifts in a row because I'm trying to squeeze things in because I have to travel. I'm super stressed about something. And then, lo and behold, nothing traumatic happens, but I experience pain because the amount of stress that I'm putting under my body is too high. And or I'm taking shortcuts or doing things that I would try to talk a client through. And I think we have to know what that feels like. I don't think we have to go so far as to, you know the exact sport, like the back of our hands, that our client is playing, but we have to know what it feels like to hurt. We have to know what it feels like to do too much and to do too little.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we talked about this recently, how we are our own like test, right? We're our own test dummy. This is where we experiment on ourselves. And, you know, at least for myself, I'd never want my clients and patients to understand like injury in relation to training. Like, I never want someone to get injured working with me in clinic. But I don't mind if it's myself experiencing pain. Like, I'd rather it be me than the people that I work with day in and day out. And I love that you brought up the conversation about, you know, the importance of understanding all these things on initial eval, how someone's moving, their pain experience, how that impacts, you know, how they're presenting to you on that day and so on that way. I notice a lot of PTs, they go to like what we call like the corrective exercise model. And they're like, well, you know, you're not moving this way. I need to get you moving that way. So here's the things I'm going to do. What exactly does that corrective exercise approach mean to you? Like when we say the term corrective, are we actually like changing the way the body moves? Are we changing the way we perceive movement? How does that apply to what we see from a like movement-based standpoint?
Yeah, I actually loathe the term corrective exercise because I think it implies that there is a correct or incorrect way to move. And that's not something I subscribe to. I think there's strategies that will create an optimal ability to reach a goal, or there's strategies that maybe aren't as optimal, so we can improve the strategies, but it's not to say that something is correct or incorrect. I try to really steer clear of that term simply because I think it just creates, you know, what we're trying to do at Old Bull is help people realize that there isn't good or bad movement. Not everything needs a diagnosis. And so we're like starting the conversation early about all of these things. And what I try to tell people, just like I'm quite agnostic about mode of exercise, I'm also quite agnostic about how you achieve a task with movement. What I care the most about, is it egregiously dangerous? If it is, I'm going to change it. Or are you moving in a way that's going to stress our target tissue? So if I have a specific tissue that I need to improve resiliency of, and again, I don't even really care if it's ligament, tendon, muscle, like I don't care. If there's a region that I want you to utilize more, I might manipulate the position to better achieve that. But if somebody's deadlift looks a certain way, but they're doing it in a way that is achieving our target tissue to be stressed, sweet, I'm not going to change it. I like people to explore movement. This comes back to neuroscience principles with training and rehab. You know, the way that we actually learn and the way that learning becomes something that over time can be more automatic is by allowing yourself to make errors and then adjust. And again, I say errors because that's more of what we would say in a neuroscience way. I don't mean errors as in incorrect movement. Let's say we have a strategy that we want you to utilize because you play a certain position in a sport, or you have an injury and I need to get your glutes stronger, for example. I want the person to explore many different strategies and to get some that aren't what we want, to get some that don't achieve the desired like target tissue. And then I want them to be able to correct, because that's how the nervous system changes. The nervous system is plastic and it's not going to change unless we input experience and then change our outputs based on our experience. So that's what motor learning is. We can't learn anything unless we, in quotations, you know, make some mistakes and then adjust. So when I'm having people move, like I'm usually not giving them a ton of feedback because I want their body to figure it out. And then when we discover a strategy that we want to try to target, that's when I'm maybe, you know, adding a few more cues in or whatever that might be.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the point too about not too much feedback, because if we sit there and we overcue everything, 12 cues, 15 cues, like do this, do this, do that, watch yourself in the mirror, but look down. Like it gets to a point where it's like no one can understand what you're actually trying to achieve. So
done that, right? Like I think we've all started
Definitely.
I used 100%. To say like 13 things for every movement. And I think you kind of have to go through that and then you peel yourself back from it. But, you know, if we think about, I think of this in two ways. You know, one way is that if I'm trying to make people be less fearful of movement or make it feel like a little bit less of a big deal, if I give them a laundry list of cues, now they're so in their head that they're like, oh my God, okay, first shoulder blades down, then neutral spine, then hips back. And then they're just going through and they're thinking this is a way bigger deal than it is. And like, it's not that serious. We can just explore movement. And then another way I think of that, Ryan Chow from, he's a founder of Reload PT in New York, an amazing place with an amazing team. He said something that's stuck with me so well. He said, a cue is a reminder. You can't remind somebody of something that they haven't learned yet. So if I'm barking orders at somebody for the first time they're performing a movement, I can't do that because they don't even have the foundation to know the movement yet. I think that helps me to shut up and not say as much when I'm working with a client, or create an environment where they're going to get into a position that I want them to without me having to tell them.
I love that. I mean, lately, my favorite cue, if you want to call it that, has just been, for the deadlift, hey, lift the bar. And then I just want to see how they do it. And then if we need to change stuff from there, or even better yet, I picked this up from someone earlier this year. I can't remember who it was, but I set a kettlebell on the ground and I say, hey, show me your goblet squat. And I'm not looking at the squat, I'm just looking at how they pick the kettlebell up. And that tells me their deadlift. I also love your point on motor learning and the importance of being willing to accept that we kind of need to make mistakes in order to get good at things. This was the part of college that I really mentally checked out of. But I think I remember something about motor development, starting when we're literally like born and we have to like stand and fall so many times before we ever walk and before we ever run and so on that way. Like, if that's how we've gotten to the point where we are today, then how come we don't look at exercise in the same way, right? Like, how come we say and accept the fact that we have to try and fail thousands of times before we walk, but we can't accept the fact that we have to try and fail thousands of times as it relates to exercise? And going off of that as well, you brought up the point of neuroplasticity. And it's amazing to me to see the look on people's faces the first time they get under, say, a bar at 315 versus when we come back to it 6 weeks later. It's the same weight, it hasn't changed. And I'll make the argument that in 6 weeks' time, we probably haven't bulked them up a ton, but their nervous system has adapted to the point where 315 no longer feels like the 315 it did before. So it really is amazing in relation to exercise how some of these basic principles that we think about in terms of how we develop as people can really impact how we develop in the world of exercise and fitness as well.
Yeah, spot on. This is where, again, I would argue that like understanding neuroscience is so important, and you don't have to get so deep into the weeds, but I do think, this is stuff that really should be at the framework of a lot of decision making for exercise, for training, for rehab. I again, you can't separate the two from each other. And I think I often think too, like it does take some time to have gone through your career a little bit to kind of realize how important this stuff is. And this might not have been something that interested you at like 24 years old, but now as you've been in practice, you've dealt with human beings, you see a little bit more. This is cool stuff to dive into, and I think people can appreciate it more. I weirdly, just like weirdly with running, I got interested in neuroscience and it became something that I was really passionate about. That doesn't happen to a lot of people. Most people told me that like I'm studying the thing that they hate the most. So I get it. But I do think as your profession kind of continues to grow, it's a really cool area to give you a lot of aha moments. A lot of it's intuitive too. You'll be like, oh, that makes sense. That's why I do it that way. I didn't even know that was like a neuroscience principle. So a lot of it is kind of intuitive. It's just nice to know maybe the foundation for why it works or why it's something that's important to do.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And one of the things I've been kind of like mentally playing around with lately, going back to what we talked about in relation to like gymnastics, is I've realized, at least for myself, I really suck at my ability to detect where I am, like in space. I really suck to do a lot of the basic, like fundamental things for like gymnastics. Like I mentioned, my handstands from earlier, or the lack thereof as it relates to handstand. And I think it's so interesting to like essentially look at how people perceive where they are in space. And we see this with exercise, right? Like, I have someone set up for a deadlift and I say, okay, just straighten your back a little bit. And then they round their back more. Like, it's so interesting to see this concept of where we feel we are versus where we actually are applied. And it's so funny because every time I think of the word proprioception, I think about how the majority of PT, at least that I've seen in the outpatient world, involves like a little piece of like blue foam that takes that completely out. And it's so like it's so crazy to think about training our ability to pick up where we are in space without actually like thinking about it that much. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, how do I think about something that I don't need to think about?
Yeah, it's you can kind of go down like a wormhole thinking about that for sure. And yeah, I agree with you. I think we learn concepts of proprioception in PT school, but in a really basic way where, again, the answer is to stand on a blue foam pad. And what proprioception is, it's ability for our body to understand where we are in space, perceive where we are in space without visual input. And that's, you know, it's interesting. It's definitely a skill that can be developed, because you do see exactly what you mentioned. I run into that all the time, people who are new to exercising, and I'm saying something that I think seems so obvious, and then they're doing the opposite, or they're like not moving at all. They're like, oh, is that it? I'm like, what do you mean? Is that it? You didn't change anything. And it's, again, it's hard for us, I think, sometimes to figure out, okay, how do I make this happen? That's where I think external cueing is really important too. And, you know, recognizing that proprioception is also from like the feedback that our joints get. So if I'm doing something super low level and really not giving my feedback, or my joints a lot of feedback with load and co-contraction of the muscles around the joint, am I actually doing anything for proprioception? Probably not. So the more that we can do where we are, you know, in that closed chain position, putting load into our system, making the muscles around the joint react, that's a greater stimulus for proprioception than standing on a foam pad, for example. So I think a lot of it just comes back to, we improve so many things when we can figure out a way to load people and to challenge their bodies. Like, that is improving so much more than, cool, they have more muscle mass or they're stronger. They're neurologically adapting to that load as well.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I think on that point as well, this is an area where I, at least personally, have come to love isometric training. It's like, hey, I'm going to set you up in the position. You've just got to build tension here. It's like, hey, pull this bar into the rack, or push this bar into the rack. Like, you know, plain and simple, like just get in the position and then learn how to build tension here. And I find over time that the more you familiarize someone with that position, the more comfortable they get there, to your point on motor learning. Like, sometimes it's almost like we need to just explore movement and explore ways to load that certain position, as opposed to just continuing to force feed the same thing over and over and over again.
For sure. And yeah, I love isometrics for all of those reasons as well. I mean, I think there's so many benefits to, you know, when we have somebody who's newer to exercise or newer to training, one of the most common things that we see is they can't create tension or control their movement with tension. And that's really hard to train. You could just bark at somebody, slow down, slow down, slow down, over and over again. But if they don't really understand what that means, the isometrics are great for that, because you have to learn how to create tension. You can't really do it wrong. Like, it's going to happen no matter what. You're pushing into something or you're just holding. And they're also an amazing entry point for people who do have pain with a specific area. Like, we can get you into a split squat isometric and load your knee up and get you comfortable with that. And you're not moving through it. It's very, for what our clients like to hear, like, it's safe. What I always tell people, like, isometrics are the first thing that I can give somebody postoperatively. It's probably pretty safe if we do this for your knee pain that's kind of bothering you today. So it's a really good entry point, and giving people a little bit of that confidence, like, oh, okay, I'm fine doing this. Even if we know they're fine doing a goblet squat, maybe they're just more comfortable with understanding, like, oh, I just have to hold this position here. So there's a lot of, I love isometrics for all those reasons too.
Yeah, and I believe there's like a very strong research-backed analgesic effect to it as well, which anytime I can give someone exercise to help reduce their pain, like, I'm going to do that 9 times out of 10. And we can take that with us wherever we go, right? Ryan and I talked about this in our episode on hunting, right? Like, if we've got someone who's going to go out on a like week long, like hunting trip, you know, I'm not going to tell them to pack like this, that, and the other thing and the foam roller and all these things to help them feel better. I'm going to tell them like pack as little as possible, because you got to carry everything with you. So I need to, like, it's my job to teach them ways to manage whatever they're going through with what they have. And I think that the isometric type of exercise really holds a lot of value here.
Agreed. And I think people are always surprised when they're like, oh, we directly stressed the area, but it feels better. So I think, again, it further bolsters what all of us are trying to do in this hybrid space, is to show people that movement isn't the bad thing. Exercise, contraction isn't the bad thing. I can give you strategies to learn how it's a tool. And anytime that I can give somebody a more active tool to help them feel better, to help them feel a little bit more in control of their pain or their symptoms, that's incredible. Like, I think that's so valuable and starts to eat away at a lot of the not so great information people get about exercise and pain. If we can start peppering in that stuff, they start to build that, like, oh, okay, this is safe and this does make me feel better. I think they're onto something, and that's pretty cool.
Is there ever a time when we do too much from an exercise standpoint, right? Like we as providers, at least I've made this mistake myself where I think more is better and I give people more. Like, hey, you know, your knee hurts, we need more quad strength. Oh, it still hurts, we just need more quad strength. And then we need more hip strength and we just need everything to have more. Is there ever a point where we almost like overdo it and give too much and would be better served by just kind of like pumping the brakes and saying, hey, look, maybe we put a little too much stress and load through the system. We should probably just back off a day or two.
Totally. Yeah, and that's the hardest part of training rehab is like finding the Goldilocks amount. How much is too much? How much is too little? What's right in the middle? And we're gonna mess it up. We're gonna cause a flare up. For sure, it's going to happen. What I always tell people is like a flare-up is a data point. Just give me more information and it's helpful. That tends to calm people down too, because we're absolutely going to do that. We're not going to always make everybody feel better. And we might get excited and push a little bit more. You know, this is where I think it comes back to understanding the person that you're working with. Like something I try to do, and I might not verbalize it, but I'm thinking about it in my head. I kind of think of people as two extremes, and of course there's gray area and overlap, but I kind of think of people as either being more likely to be an overdoer versus an underdoer. And somebody who's an underdoer is probably not quite pushed themselves very hard, or their programming does not match the intensity that their goal activity does, or they just haven't really developed really good training habits. And then on the other end of the spectrum is the overdoer, who they are training multiple times a day sometimes. They don't know how to say no. They're on all the time. That's probably going to be the person that I have to dial back some. And a lot of times my answer isn't more training. It's probably like, let's look at your stress of training over the week and we have to swap some things out or, you know, maybe modify the intensity in some way. Because we can absolutely do too much and not in a way that's dangerous, but again, more that's just like, we've exceeded what your current capacity is. So we have to dial back and figure it out.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I love that point on trying to almost like subtype the people that you work with in a certain way of how they are as a person, their characteristics, and that sort of thing. This is something that I really first became familiar with through a guy named Johnny Fabrisius. He proposed a model of training and how we go about prescribing exercise based on how someone presents from like a neurotransmitter standpoint. So how someone like, do they present with like a low dopamine, low acetylcholine type of presentation? Do they go more of like a high GABA, low noradrenaline presentation, and literally like looking into how people present from a neurologic standpoint and almost like tailoring what we do from an exercise standpoint accordingly. And that's an area that just like completely blew my mind, you know, to bits because I'd never thought about it like that. Like I've thought about prescribing exercise and programming exercise for people based on what they like, but never like the type of person that they are.
Totally. And you could even think of it even more simply than that, of just like understanding in general people who tend to maybe be more sympathetically driven versus parasympathetically driven. And, you know, in Miami, with the population that we have, we all have a lot of high performing CEOs, like people who are very, very sympathetically driven, and they are on all of the time. So that might be a conversation point of, you know, these are a lot of times these are the people who are doing like HIIT classes every day, and everything they're doing is super high intensity. They're redlining every session. They're very sympathetically driven as it is, and they're just kind of giving that feedback constantly. And again, it's not that we shouldn't have intensity. I think you can go so far on that direction and say that everybody should only do zone two. I don't agree with that at all. But I think we do, this is where it comes into play of like, you might have to tailor your program to what somebody's, as you said, personality or kind of a subtype of, if this person's super wound up all the time, maybe I can compromise with them and get them to do three HIIT classes a week and then two slow and steady like strength sessions where they're not getting that red line heart rate response and that super high training stress.
Yeah, exactly. And this comes back to a point that I feel like I just say almost like every podcast episode anymore is like the importance of getting to know the people that you work with, not just the diagnoses, but actually putting like people first and really like spending time with them. Like this is where the one-on-one approach to rehab or a very individualized strength and conditioning program really comes into play, right? And I know that's exactly how you do things there in Florida. Like if I see five or six people at a time, I never really get to know any of them. I really can't provide that well for any of them. I'm really just guessing at what they need. So I think the more we get to know people and focus on them as a human instead of just, hey, this is what they're here to see me for, the better our results and outcomes are going to be, not just from a physical sense, but even like a like biopsychosocial or neurologic sense as well.
For sure. And, you know, I think one of the still biggest issues with healthcare and with people experiencing pain is that they get so much scary and bad information that it really warps their view of their body, their themselves, their life. You all it takes is telling somebody after you've seen their MRI that they have the knees of an 80-year-old and you don't understand how they're walking, for them to now think that forever they have bad knees and they can't do anything about it. That is life altering, and it's so dangerous and it's so bad. And I think if people come to see us, we get to slowly undo that. And it takes time. Like, it's not perfect when a lot of the world around us is set up for people to believe those things. You know, if we don't offer that experience of being able to get somebody away from attaching to a diagnosis. And again, like I always say this as a caveat, like, if a diagnosis is important, I'm not just not saying it because I want to prove a point. Like if there's an important diagnosis, if there are specific contraindications or things that I need to make somebody aware of, I'm absolutely saying it. But most of the time, all it's doing is now creating this person's identity centered around this diagnosis that they've been told. So the more we can get away from that, and the more we can help somebody understand that there's a lot more that goes into their pain or injury, the better, and hopefully the better as a whole healthcare continues to get.
I love that point because we are far from perfect and still trying to be better. And that's, I think, why we call it the practice of healthcare is we're all just out here doing our best. And one thing I've noticed makes a huge difference for individuals in that bucket is kind of like relating what they're going through to what someone else has gone through, right? So I have someone who comes to see me with a, you know, MRA confirmed labrum tear. Well, for some people that might mean surgery, but I know someone and worked with someone who had a labrum tear on MRA and they can do 30 pull-ups. So maybe sometimes structure dictates function, but maybe sometimes it doesn't. So trying to undo that perception of like, every time we see something bad does not mean that like life is over. It's almost like a new challenge, or, you know, the same way you brought up aging earlier, it's time for us to level up what we do and adapt to the current state of our body.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such a good way to think about it too. And I think what's helpful, like I think what most patients are just scared of something being dangerous for their pain or their diagnosis. So what I often start that kind of conversation with is I'll just say, you know, my job is to make sure that the things that I do for you don't put you in danger. And if there is an issue or if there is a structural thing going on that would be dangerous, I'm going to tell you. Like, also looks bad for me. Like, it's malpractice if I don't. I want to keep my business open. I will tell you if something is out of my scope, if something needs to get further looked at, if something is dangerous. Like, that's my literal job. Otherwise, we are going to progress and do everything that is totally safe and within the limitations that we currently have. And I think just like addressing somebody's fears like that head on is really important. And it humanizes the experience too. Like, I'm not a know-it-all. I'm going to make mistakes, but my whole goal is to keep you safe. I'm always going to keep you safe. And I think that's really, really important. Most people in pain, especially in chronic pain, they just feel unsafe all of the time. So if you can provide just a semblance of that safety and like just lower that threat that they're constantly having, that goes a long way.
I love that. It's got to be, I can't relate to this myself, but it's got to be crazy to be in your body and feel unsafe in the sense of being in pain for years and years and decades, and in some cases longer than I've even been alive. Like, it's crazy to try and like just wrap the head around what that does to the body and what that does to a person.
Yeah, totally. And it's changing your physiology. It's changing how you respond to things. It's changing, you mentioned neurotransmitters. It's changing the chemical signaling. It's changing, your stress responses going off all of the time. And all that is a cascade of chemical events that create physiological changes. And that wears on people. It's something that agreed, like if we haven't really experienced that type of chronic pain, we've all experienced aches and pains, but cr true chronic pain, I think, is just a different animal. And it's something that, again, I think sometimes we take for granted of how deeply and how well we understand the body. And I understand that going down the stairs, if I feel a twinge in my knee, it doesn't mean anything. I just was in a position that loaded my knee and I felt it. And but the average person, when they go down the stairs and they feel something in their knee, they sometimes literally think they just like tore their meniscus, or they think they just created something great enough to be truly like structural damage. People really believe that. And it's really hard to undo that thought process. And I agree. I couldn't imagine walking around feeling that way all the time. And that's why I'm hopeful that more people find providers like yourself and people like our team at Old Bull to be able to get some of those fears quelled a little bit, because it's a lot.
The other crazy piece to all this is you've brought up chronic pain and a variety of different things. My population tends to be a lot of high school and college athletes. I see a lot of, post-op ACL, post-op hip, that sort of thing. And for a lot of them, they're experiencing pain or injury for the first time. But in a sense, I'm not just treating what I see right now. I also need to treat the 5 years, the 10 years, the 20 years down the line from right now. We did a podcast recently with Kyle Sammons, and we brought up isometrics, and we brought up the concept of like you literally cannot do enough isos, especially after something like an ACL reconstruction, which is probably done with a tendon graft, right? Like, I don't want the athlete to just be feeling good and pain-free and back to what they want to do now. I want that 10 years from now, 20 years from now, because part of putting an end to this chronic pain cycle and cascade that you just outlined is nipping it before it ever happens. And if I don't do a good enough job of that, or I don't educate someone on the importance of some of these different things like tendon loading now, then where are they going to be in 20 or 30 years from now? Yeah, maybe I'm not their provider anymore. Maybe they're in a different part of the country, whatever. But ultimately, if we're trying to humanize this and improve our state of healthcare and just overall prevent this chronic pain cycle, then we have to start right now, even when people are like 15 years old, and not just wait for them to be like 50 and start treating chronic pain.
Yeah, that's a great way of thinking about it too, and empowering, right? Like if we're working with a younger population, think of how many clients come in and see you and they tell you something that their physician told them 15 years ago, like an older adult. They remember. People remember what figures of authority tell them. They remember the physician who told them that they could never lift more than 10 pounds again, because it's the first thing they bring up when they come in for an evaluation. So I want to be the provider that they remember because I've told them how much they're capable of. I want that to be carried with them forever instead of the opposite, which we usually get, like, oh yeah, I had this surgery, or I had an ACL repair and when I was 15, the person's 40 now, and they were like, yeah, I was just told I should never run again. People remember that stuff. So we could be on the opposite end of that and provide them with information that they remember that's positive and empowering and shows them, we don't break down. We get more resilient. We get more capacity. We improve our function.
Yeah, no, definitely. I love that approach, and I love overall just the entire like thought process that you have behind rehab, training, and just overall how you go about your day to day. I've heard so many great things about you, from how much work you do on a typical day to how much knowledge you consume. Out of everything that you do, has there been anything in particular that you really found benefit from that you would recommend to other people? Are there certain like books that you liked, or certain courses that you took, or just certain like daily practices that you found really benefited you to get to where you are today, Katie?
I think A few things, like if we go more directly and think about, content to consume that's helpful, I think listening to podcast episodes like this of people who are just having a conversation that might be in a realm that you enjoy, I think it's one of the best ways to get a lot of information that's, I think, not as aggressive as, scouring PubMed and analyzing journal articles. Not all of us have time to do that. I certainly don't either. So I think that's like a really kind of low barrier to entry way to listen to these conversations and get information. On the opposite end of the spectrum, this is something that I'm trying to do more of. I also do think we have to conserve our creative energy and find ways to get out of our bubble. Everything that I think about all day, everything that I do is movement, science, exercise all day. So I on purpose consume content that's the exact opposite of that. I will listen to podcasts that have nothing to do with any of these fields. I will read books that have nothing to do with any of these fields. And I just think we do have to step away. I'm my most creative when I come back from a trip where I've been able to unwind. So I think like we can find the best social media accounts to follow. We can listen to podcasts. We can read books. All of that is very important, but I do think we have to get away from it sometimes too. And it's hard, especially if you're trying to build a brand or grow a business. Or for us, we take so intimately close to our hearts, like every case that we work on with a patient. And I do think you have to find something for yourself as well. That's been really helpful for me.
Yeah, I completely agree. And finding a way to kind of step back from the situation, reassess, re-engage, and get back into the, for lack of a better way to put it, get back into the fight. I love that point. As you were saying that, though, I couldn't help but think you seem like a true crime person, Katie.
Who's telling you all of this information about how I like cheese and I do love true crime?
That was the true crime was actually a guess. That was
That's
shooting from the
hilarious.
hip.
I am a big, huge true crime fan. That is predominantly the content that I consume that's not fitness related. My boyfriend makes fun of me because that's like when I want to unwind, I'm like, let's watch murder. And he's like, how is that an unwinding activity at all? And then, but it's hilarious because he's getting into it now too. So, there you go.
Just wake up and choose violence. It solves all the problems.
Right? I know. I don't really know how much that's doing for me to like unwind because I'm having a literal stress response while watching it. But, it is what it is.
That's amazing. Katie, I feel like we covered so much ground today from I feel like it was just the Katie Dabrowski podcast, really, from cheese to training to neuro stuff to true crime. Is there anything that we missed or any kind of closing thoughts that you have?
No, I think we covered all of my passions in life, really. And I'm almost positive. Does that mean that Ryan Murphy has told you the cheese question to ask? Because I feel like that would be something he would say to ask.
So I actually thought of it on my own,
Oh, because of how obvious it
and then
is.
approved it with him, and he
So
then
shoot him a
suggest
text later.
he then suggested that we do a hour-long podcast on cheese.
I mean, no, but if you would like your ratings to plummet and have no listeners, that's fine. I would have a great time. I could do that all day. But no, I feel like we covered all of my greatest passions in life. So you asked great questions. I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate your time, Katie. And like I said, I absolutely love what you do and everything that you do that way. For people who want to check out what you're doing on the day-to-day, where can they find you at online and in person?
So two of in Old Bull we have, or in Miami we have two of our locations. If anybody is in the South Florida area and needs anything, Instagram's a great way. Our Instagram is Old Bull Athletics, and our second location is just Old Bull Athletics Pinecrest. You can also find me on Instagram. That's a really easy way to get in touch about anything. And our entire team, again, they're all over Instagram as well. Like everybody at Old Bull is just truly exceptional. I can't speak highly enough of all of them. So if anybody has questions, needs anything, whether you're a future patient, a provider who's interested in understanding more of what we do, somebody who's just curious about this space, every single person on Old Bull is an excellent representation of the team and would be a person to reach out to.
We'll link to all that in the description below. I also feel like you do some like courses and you like travel the country and teach like kettlebells and training as healthcare and stuff too. If someone wants to find out about that, where can they find that at?
Instagram's another great resource, but yes, we do offer continuing education courses for trainers and rehab providers and students who are interested in this kind of model of care. Training as healthcare is the main course that we offer. We'll be in the Southern California area in July, and kind of stay tuned for other offerings. Our website, oldbullathletics.com, has all of this information too. And then, yeah, we also offer a kettlebell course to really teach like foundations of kettlebells. And it's a coaching course for sure, where in real time we're kind of finding areas that could be improved upon and finding drills to like bury the skill in the drill and coach somebody through. My business partner, the founder of Old Bull, Frankie Telfort, who's incredible, started all of this and created what Old Bull is now today. He leads that kettlebell course. He's one of the biggest kettlebell advocates and freakishly strong. So if you want to learn kettlebells, that's the guy to learn it from. So we offer both of those courses, and you can check that out on our website too.
That is amazing. Katie, I really appreciate your time and for everything today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.